You are listening to the Smart Betting Club podcast with me, your host, Peter Lin. For the very latest on what it takes to make your betting profitable, including the experts you should follow, please visit the SBC website at smartbettingclub.com.
My guest today is lawyer Harry Stewart Moore, who is a partner at the law firm Gardner Leader and who specialises in betting. Harry regularly acts for some of the leading names in the gambling world in both high court proceedings and before various sports regulatory panels, with a preference to represent those on the punting side of things, including many professional bettors in the past. Harry explained the type of cases he takes on and some of the issues and grievances brought before him. Many of them do focus on bookmaker behaviour, alongside issues created by the industry and its regulator, the Gambling Commission, about whom he has very many concerns as to the way they operate. We also expand on the black market, its growth, and the legal challenges that creates, as well as why frictionless affordability checks just won't work and the problems with many bookmakers' terms and conditions. Nothing was off the agenda in this wide-reaching chat, and Harry was a fascinating guest, happy to share his thoughts and experiences on all things betting from a legal perspective. So sit back and enjoy my chat with gambling lawyer Harry Stewart Moore. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of being joined by gambling lawyer Harry Stewart Moore, who is a partner in the law firm Gardner Leader. Now, Harry, there is plenty to get stuck into today for us, especially given the current climate in the betting world. But before all of that, a little bit about you and what drew you into the betting world. I believe it stems from your father.
That's right. Yes. My dad was a well-known sports and media lawyer, particularly in horse racing. He was closely associated with Kieran Fallon for many years. And he'd been a keen racing enthusiast before that. And he sort of fell into horse racing work. I got my interest in horse racing and gambling from him. And I sort of started getting more interested when I was at university up in the Northeast. And then I sort of slightly fell into gambling work through BHA work. I was doing some work on betting conspiracies, and that involved really having to get to grips with some quite complex betting records in the relatively early days of exchanges. And from that, I just started to develop a reputation as someone who knew a bit about gambling and, you know, a bit about the law, really.
So the ideal person to go to when you had a problem or a gambling grievance.
Yeah. My marketing team would definitely say the ideal person to go to, yeah.
There we go. So you're obviously interested in betting yourself. You bet a lot yourself, just as a hobby, I imagine, but something you enjoy.
That's right. I mean, one of the things I've learned from working for so many successful gamblers is how much work goes into gambling successfully. So in a way, I'm quite loath to, I don't spend large sums because I know, you know, I self-identify as a mug basically nowadays because I just don't have the time to put the work in, you know, in a previous life. And actually, I got back into it in COVID a bit. I used to spend a lot of time sort of poring over speed figures and that sort of thing, and was able to, particularly at university, which is a long time ago now, was able to make money. But it's not something that you can make money at unless you really work at it. And one way or another, I decided that being a lawyer was perhaps the more sensible route, but I could still prove wrong.
Of course. No, but it's good to point out that you are actually interested in betting. That obviously naturally, you know, aligns with your work. But from that point of view, it's good to know.
Yes.
So obviously specialize in betting. And what type of cases and clients do you take on? Are you able to, you know, outline a few example cases in the past and the type of work?
So, I mean, historically, it's almost all been high net worth punters, and many of whom are professional, whether, you know, to the extent that that is a meaningful term, professional punters, people who do it for their, you know, main source of income. And a lot of it is obviously trying to extract money from bookmakers, and a lot of it is trying to extract money from other punters and commission agents and debts over poker games, that sort of thing. So that's been the traditional type of client. I have taken on some what people call problem gambling cases over the years. Not many. I don't particularly like them. They're very difficult. And so I try to avoid those. The only real one I've done was for someone who was actually the victim of a problem gambler who had their, it was an elderly couple who'd had their life savings stolen by a family member who had then lost it to a bookmaker. So that was the only one I really took on in anything like a substantial way. But increasingly, you know, it's all sorts of people, and you don't just work for the gamblers in the capacity of gamblers. You know, they've very often got other business interests as well, particularly in horse racing, for example. So I do a lot of work both for gamblers in gambling and for, you know, gambling people in other ways.
Okay. And you don't just work for punters, do you? You do also do work for bookmakers, I assume?
I do. I don't work for big bookmakers. Okay. And that's partly a choice, really, because I think that you have to slightly be on one side of it. But independent bookmakers, absolutely. And I enjoy my work for independent bookmakers. Yeah. So I suppose the only ones I'd rule out are the very big players.
Okay. Do you want to expand on why, or do you just want to leave it there?
Well, I think probably a lot of them wouldn't particularly want to employ me after the relationships I've developed with them over the years. But it works both ways. I think that it's better to be on, you know, my niche is on the side of the punters in that particular battle. I consider independents to be sort of neutrals in the middle. So I'm very happy to act for them. And I think that their behaviour is a great deal better, generally speaking. It's difficult. I wouldn't really enjoy working for some of the big bookmakers, given, you know, given the arguments that they're sometimes required to put forward I just don't think that doesn't sound like much fun to me. So I can't see myself doing that in a hurry.
No, well, it's good to know you're on the side of the punter or for that. Good. Yes. To have you on to talk about that. And so obviously the number of grievances and people, the problems that people have with bookmakers, especially those large ones, has seemingly grown in recent years. Would you say that's your experience as well? Are you getting more people coming to you with complaints about their behaviour?
Yes, I am. But it's hard to know in these things whether what's happening is, whether there's more of it or it's just becoming more, there's more public knowledge about it.
Sure.
Because when I first started doing this, the explosion, I was told, in website visits from, you know, a couple of mentions in the media about doing gambling cases was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And I think the reason for that was that actually there were an awful lot of people out there who had gone to lawyers who perhaps didn't know what they were doing or just hadn't gone to lawyers at all. So my point really is that I think actually there has been for some time an awful lot of this, and it's quite hard to know whether there's more of it now or whether it's just that punters are doing a bit more to try and get their money back now.
I see. And so in terms of some of the common issues that people are coming to you with or interested in, is it, for example, trying to extract money from an account where bookmakers are being particularly difficult? What type of disputes and issues are being raised most commonly?
That is a very common one, of course, but it's really broad. You know, as I say, it's from things like an elderly couple finding their life savings have been stolen and gambled with a particular operator. It's ones where bookmakers have taken bets and then said, actually, that's over the daily limit for that market. It's, well, we don't know who you are and, you know, we're worried that you might be involved in financial crime. That one's a particularly irritating one because it's always raised far too late. Mm-hmm. The whole gambit, really. I've got some now where you've got bookmakers saying you've taken too long to withdraw under our terms and conditions. Bookmakers have tried, the big bookmakers I'm talking about here, I think it's important to make that distinction because,
of course,
I've never actually, I don't think, had to bring a claim against what might loosely be described as an independent bookmaker. So I think that is an important distinction. And yes, they try everything. You know, these are huge companies with departments called things like the Loss Prevention Department and that kind of thing. And they do an awful lot of afters trying to work out ways of getting out of liabilities. So, you know, almost anything that you can think of, palpable errors that aren't palpable errors, you know, I've had ones where they've had a term and condition that refers to an error. And I've had bookmakers basically saying, well, we didn't really mean to lay that bet, because we hadn't realized that it was your client might win such a large sum of money. And that's an error. You know, I've had arguments that ridiculous. And others, you know, others are better. Not all punters are angels and not all punters are right. There are sometimes even shades of grey in between the two positions where you can sort of see actually both sides have a point here. But there isn't much I haven't seen, I suppose.
So it's a wide range, a myriad of different cases and issues that get brought to the fore. But it does seem there is obviously some of these firms, or these big firms, do have major departments all designed to perhaps delay or prevent payment. I was explaining it to
lot of journalists recently in terms of insurance companies, you know, trying to wriggle out if your house burns down, the little box that you didn't tick or the terms and condition that precludes them from paying out. Feels a bit similar to that.
I do quite a lot of insurance litigation as well. I'd say insurers wouldn't get anywhere close to some of the arguments that bookmakers have tried to avoid getting out. They're much more commercially sensible. They're much more reputationally concerned. And that subject we'll get on to, they're properly regulated. It's a very good analogy, but I would just make the point that actually it's a slightly unfair comparison on there are not many people who would sit down and defend the insurance market. But I think in comparison to major bookmakers, they're relatively straightforward to deal with.
Okay, so even lower than insurance companies.
That's the way of putting it, yes.
Okay, I was going to mention, I spoke to a gentleman 2 years ago with one major firm. We're not going to name any firms particularly today. And his case involved this particular firm, and it was his account in his name. It was confirmed to me by someone I trust that was the case. They made him go to small claims court to pay out his winnings. Now, they took him through the small claims court route. They, along the way, told him, oh, you're going to have to pay our legal fees. We've got a huge amount of evidence. Now, they get to small claims court and they fold on the day of the case. And they say, oh, we don't have anything. And it feels like that's just one case in isolation. But it does seem like some of these departments, if you like, there's a whole way of working, which is to make life as difficult and try and prevent people from going down this route and game the system as much as possible to prevent payout. Is that a case in isolation, or have you seen that kind of thing?
I've definitely seen that. I've not gone, rather naughty of whoever that operator was to suggest to your guy that they might get a costs award against him, because you don't get costs award in the small claims court. And that's one of the benefits, but also the challenges. You can, in very, very, very rare circumstances, get costs awards, but they shouldn't have been threatening him with a costs award, in my view. Yes, you do. I think I've heard it referred to as, is it slow rolling, where they're trying to make it as difficult as possible for punters, whether that's just become a mentality or that they think there is a commercial advantage to it. You would have thought that the man hours spent on that kind of thing weren't really worth it. But yes, definitely, I've dealt with ones where I do think it's the mentality of a certain type of bookmaker, which is, even if they sort of accept somewhere that they're probably going to have to pay out, they just don't want to tick that box today. You know, they don't want to tick it today. They just want to push it backwards and backwards. And something might come up. Something might stop this person continuing to claim. I think that's a very common mentality. And actually, I think a lot behind a lot of the problems, which is just a refusal in the first instance to accept that they need to pay out. And that then sort of solidifies into something more concerning, which is a right not to pay out over time. I think that's behind a lot of the problems.
And that's obviously small claims court. You'll deal with bigger cases, no doubt. Do many of those settle out of court? How often do they actually go to in front of, you know, a judge and a ruling comes up?
Extremely rare to go as far as a trial. They almost all settle one way or another. They don't necessarily settle on the most fantastic terms for my client always. You know, things can come out in disclosure, for example, that can mean that the client is in more difficulties than you'd thought when you first advised, and you have to take a view on that. Most litigation settles. You know, I think I read a statistic the other day that you know, something like 2% of, or you know, a very small number of claims that are issued actually end up in a full trial, because it's expensive, and no matter how strong your claim is, it's risky. We've had very good results. I would say we've got a very good rate of return over the years. And that's partly because bookmakers are very often advancing very bad arguments, but also it's partly because when you litigate, you up the risk for everyone.
And I was going to ask you about, obviously, AML checks. That seems to be a regular query that people have, especially the people that come to me. Bookmakers suggesting there's anti-money laundering or financial checks that they need to oversee. Is that something that comes up regularly in terms of the cases that you get put forward, where bookmakers are being using AML or that kind of money checks to prevent payout?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that my own experience is that there are fewer cases based on that now. I'm getting cases based on other things. But for a period of perhaps 5 years, it was constant. Now we've got affordability checks, which brings it back up, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. But it was constant. I've had ones where I think a guy deposited, you know, 200 quid, had lost sums over about a year, deposited 200 quid. I think he turned it into 40 grand, having been a loser of sort of 10 grand a year. And they could not have been more difficult. That was a major operator that said if he wanted to sue, he had to sue them in Curacao or somewhere like that, which was wrong. They refused to accept service of documents in this country. They said that they couldn't pay out until he proved where his 200 quid had come from. He did. He showed that it would have come from his limited company. They were then sort of, but how do we know whether that limited company? I mean, it was just ridiculous. It was absolutely farcical. Now, those ones pay out in full very quickly, but the mentality was utterly extraordinary and wouldn't exist in any other industry. There's been an awful lot of that. And of course, it's all afters. It's almost always on withdrawal and on substantial withdrawal. You know, bookmakers panic when they think they're paying out money that's not going to come back, basically. Yeah. They don't mind if they think that the punter has been lucky and is going to keep punting away and maintain their losing ways. But this guy suddenly had such a big win that they were worried that that was money they were going to pay out they weren't going to see again. And so the mentality was just, how do we stop that? Oh, asking where his 200 quid came from. And then when he explains, ask him where his limited company, which was successful, I think it was a successful events company, where that had come from. So that was hugely frustrating. And the real frustration there actually was with the Gambling Commission, which had allowed that, in my view, had allowed that kind of practice to continue and flourish, because it wasn't saying to bookmakers, well, wait a minute, why have you got this money if you're worried about it? Why did you accept it in the first place? And as far as I'm aware, they have never addressed that question. I know I bang that drum rather loudly and often, but it does strike me as an utterly extraordinary lacuna in the regulation.
Yeah, because the point I would say, just to finish that one, is there must be a lot of people who deposit £200 and then lose that money, and the bookmaker doesn't question the source of that particular income.
Absolutely. This is the other point. Had my client given up, what the bookmaker is then left with, correspondence on its files saying, we're concerned that your money could potentially proceed to crime. The customer then disappears and there they are sitting on it. At that point, that is their problem from a criminal liability point of view, because they have in their possession the potential proceeds of crime. So if you follow that through to its end game, where do you end up? You know, and how much money is sitting in the bank accounts of major bookmakers, where there is correspondence from those bookmakers saying, we're worried that this is the proceeds of crime. I mean, it is utterly extraordinary when you think about it like that.
It is. I mean, what happens to that cash? But the bigger question is, well, are they sitting on money which is from the proceeds of crime, has a question mark over it? Shouldn't that be investigated? It's a very important question.
To get more technical, yes, it should be investigated. And this is the other thing, was what they were supposed to do is there's a very prescriptive method by which you do this. If you're worried about a transaction, you're supposed to report it in a certain way to the National Crime Agency, effectively. The National Crime Agency look into it. And within a certain period of time, they either say, we're not worried about it, go ahead, or we're taking over this and it's going to become a criminal investigation. So plainly, the bookmakers who were engaged in this tactic weren't doing that. They were not making the reports to the National Crime Agency that they were legally bound to make, not just by their regulator, but by the Proceeds of Crime Act. And they just weren't doing it. And they weren't doing it because they weren't genuinely concerned that the money was the proceeds of crime. But they were doing a sort of switcheroo of the burden of proof and saying, well, you prove to us that it's not the proceeds of crime, even though we've got no real basis to think it might be. And then if we make your life difficult enough, you might give up and we might keep the money.
And does that fall under the jurisdiction of the Gambling Commission to ask those questions? Or is there another agency? Surely there must be someone or somebody interested in exploring that topic.
You'd hope there were several bodies interested in exploring that sort of thing, including the police, frankly, and the National Crime Agency. But once regulators step in, public bodies like the police and the National Crime Agency do tend to think, well, actually, that's a regulated industry. That's for you to sort out. If that isn't something the commission should have been interested in, then you do have to wonder what it is that they are interested in, because one of their aims is to keep gambling safe and free from crime. I just think the answer to that is basically yes, of course it's the Gambling Commission's job.
So let's talk about them then. You've read them a few times. They're obviously not much love for them, and you must have extensive experience in dealing with them in your line of work as well. What's your opinion on dealing with them at the moment?
Funny enough, I haven't had extensive experience in recent years because I've just given up.
Okay.
In the early years, we used to try and involve them in things, and you just never got anywhere at all. My experience of them was that they were bordering on secretive when you dealt with them. They would never tell you the name of the person investigating a matter. They wouldn't tell you if the matter was being investigated. They wouldn't tell you the surname of the person that you were speaking to. And they just made life very difficult. The time I finally gave up on them was when I was engaged in a dispute with a bookmaker that I thought was trying to mislead my client as to its legal identity, as to its name. You may not have looked into this, but if you ever look a lot of these slightly more exotic bookmakers up, they've got lots of different limited companies with slightly similar names, and one might be might be a holding company registered in Curacao, and one might be the licensed entity in London that's actually got the license. And we were concerned that we were being misled as to who we should be suing to get the money back. And so we wrote to the Gambling Commission and said, who's on the license? You need to, it appears to us that the wrong person is on the license. And I'd previously written to the operator themselves and said this, and the operator had come back through its lawyers with a completely ridiculous argument under the Companies Act, saying actually it doesn't matter whether it's called this or this, which is just simply wrong. If you sue the wrong person in this jurisdiction, the wrong entity, you're in real trouble. And so I wrote to the Gambling Commission about it, and I got back from them chapter and verse what the lawyer for the operator had said to me. And the only thing I can think of is that they, instead of investigating themselves, they simply went to the operator and said, what's your answer to this? And then they regurgitated that to me. And when I pointed that out to them, as far as I can recall, I never got a response. And so that was the last time I bothered, really. And that was probably not far off. It was probably 7 or 8 years ago. And I think that I might have had one client who was a responsible gambling client who asked me to report a bookmaker. And then you just get the letter, which I think everyone's had over the years, which is, well, we're not really going to tell you what we're going to do with this information, basically. Mm-hmm. So I don't involve myself with them. And so one of the reasons I say that is because it's, whatever I say next should be caveated by the fact that it's possible that there has been a huge change in the level of service since I last dealt with them, and that they're actually a great deal better. So that's why I think it's fair to say that I haven't had a lot to do with them in recent years.
I don't think so. I think it's got worse.
Yeah, but so what I say now is much more based on the information that is in the public realm and that everyone knows. And I think it's gone from a body that sort of was scared of gambling, didn't really understand it, and wanted really to simplify it into problem gambling. I think the Gambling Commission was only ever really interested in the bits that it could regulate without understanding gambling. So, for example, child protection, they were always very interested in whether on-course bookmakers, for example, had signs on their board saying no under 18s. They would take a huge interest in things like that. Or gambling harm, partly because that gets an awful lot more media attention, and partly because it doesn't really involve much understanding of gambling as a pastime or an industry. But I think that what is morphing into now is something a little bit more dangerous, which is a body with its own political views on gambling. I say that because of firstly, because of the approach that it's taken now. It's become quite combative.
Yeah.
And secondly, because it does things like, now I had no idea until Andrew Rhodes said it the other day, that the Gambling Commission considers the National Lottery to be a sort of morally elevated, or morally is perhaps not quite the right word, but much less of a concern than any other type of gambling. And the reason for that appears to be that lottery funds are used for good causes, you know, building gyms and all this sort of thing, and botanical gardens. And there's no doubt that National Lottery money is used for good purposes, but that does not change the underlying relationship of the punter and the game they're playing. We don't say, well, look, let's legalize heroin and we'll take 90% of it and put it into primary school. The fact that you can tax something and make money out of it for what might be good causes is neither here nor there when you're assessing the safety of the underlying product. Anyone who has stood in queues in a Tesco's Express very often will have seen that there are people who do not have a particularly healthy relationship with National Lottery scratch cards, for example. That, to me, is a political position that the Commission has taken, which is that National Lottery is less of a risk because of the good that it does. But it's also simplistic because, of course, all money paid to bookmakers pays people's wages, pays shareholders. Ultimately, if you're talking about big gambling companies, it goes into pension pots, it goes into massive pension schemes. All that money benefits people. But the point is, the damage it does on the way in. It's not what good the money does on the way out. And I think that is an extraordinary position to have taken, and one that the regulator shouldn't be taking. It should be treating all gambling as the same, subject to scientific data on it. So in other words, if you've got scientific data that suggests national lottery gambling is less harmful than greyhound gambling, or for example, then you can regulate on that basis, but you can't do it on the basis that national lottery money is used for positive projects.
Oh, it all makes sense. You raise some very important points there. And I read a piece from Regulus Partners, which talked about the regulator's code, which is based on something called the Nolan Principles of Impartiality. And it would appear that the Gambling Commission are failing on that front at the moment.
I will bow to Regulus Partners on that, because that's really much more their bag. It's the sort of is the real nitty-gritty of the regulatory law in gambling, which isn't quite what I do. But you just got to look at the state of gambling in this country, the state of horse racing in this country at the moment, and what has happened in the last 20 years that might explain all of this. Well, I'm afraid it is the establishment, it's the Gambling Act 2005 and the establishment of the Gambling Commission.
So in terms of the Gambling Commission, do you think there's scope for them to continue as they are? Or do you believe that with all these coming storms, we haven't even talked about the National Lottery, there's a lot of issues in terms of the award of the contract for that more recently, and in bigger, perhaps bigger stories and individual punter cases that we're dealing with, Russian money and assets and things like that. Do you feel that the Gambling Commission will have to evolve and change in terms of how the industry can move forward?
I think to an extent the horse has bolted because of the extent of the black market. Now, it's never going to get its hands on the black market. And the black market is now, I suspect, a great deal bigger than the Gambling Commission wants to let on. And the other thing about the Gambling Commission is that it's, you know, like a lot of regulators, frankly, nowadays, is one of the things that it's most concerned about is the public perception of its performance. And so it's in the interest of the Gambling Commission to say, we think the black market's been overstated. Who are they asking? Who on earth are they asking? Because no one that I act for is going to be talking to the Gambling Commission about whether they use the black market.
But that's what Andrew Rhodes said at the Parliament.
By the way, it's really important that we define what we mean by black market here, because it could sound quite dodgy in other contexts. What I mean is unregulated operators, for example, in other countries, or there's this thing called the grey market. And there are also things that perhaps, you know, I wouldn't call black market at all, which is high-rolling punters placing large bets with each other. And going back to my original point, I think that it's unfortunately in the interest of the Gambling Commission to say that the black market isn't that big, because of course, otherwise it looks like it hasn't been doing a very good job. And I rather fear that's the approach to most of the way that it regulates. These press releases saying, look how much we fined so-and-so. But you get no concept, for example, of how much the operator has made as a result of those breaches. So it's all very well saying, we fined William Hill, what was it? It was nearly 100 million quid or something. It was something huge. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was. But how do you know if that's a big fine if you don't know how much William Hill made as a result of the breaches in question? If William Hill had made 400 million quid from that, then 90 million quid just becomes a relatively modest cost of doing business.
It goes back to the lack of transparency and clarity from the commission. Yeah. So you mentioned black market there. Is it mainly websites working overboard, or is it a lot of private individuals, people who are using internet communication like WhatsApp and Telegram to lay bets from their own bedroom? Or is it mainly websites?
To be honest with you, I've not really been that closely involved in any litigation involving what might loosely be termed the black market. And so what I know about it is more from conversations with my clients about it. I'm uncomfortable really using the phrase black market, because a lot of these individuals, particularly ones abroad who don't have British licenses, I get the impression that a lot of punters think they're more straightforward to deal with than some licensed bookmakers in this jurisdiction. And again, that is not a particularly good light to have shone on it by the Gambling Commission. But you know, the black market is to an extent, I'm afraid, it's a creation of the failures of regulation for such a long time, because the practices that big bookmakers got up to in the first sort of 10 or 15 years of regulation by the Gambling Commission created the black market, because people were finding it so difficult to deal with traditional licensed operators. Those are the circumstances in which you create a need for people who will take bets and will pay out on them. And that is how, you know, for example, a lot of betting, as you'll know, Peter, is now taking place in Southeast Asia and India. That wouldn't really be happening if this market, you know, had been properly regulated over the last 10, 15 years, it would still happen to an extent because bookmakers are not going to happily pay out winning punters. But it has been accelerated and exacerbated by bookmakers having been allowed to behave in the way that they did. And who do you blame, really? There's a joke in The Simpsons where I can't remember what it was, but you know, one of the children is driving the car and you say, well, do you, and crashes it. And you say, well, do you blame the child driving the car or blame the adult that gave him the car keys and said, get into the car and off you go? And I rather feel like that with the relationship between the big operators and the regulator. What did everyone expect bookmakers to do if they weren't properly regulated? That is the huge difficulty. And it's not that I don't have some sympathies for the regulators, because they're a new regulator. They were a new thing, the Gambling Commission. And I just think it took them far too long. And when I say took them, it's still taking them far too long to catch up with the commercial realities of big bookmakers and particularly online bookmaking. I just don't think they were remotely ready for what bookmakers would be able to do via use of the internet, basically.
It's interesting all that point, chatting to some punters out in North America, they talk about how extensive PPH outfits are, which are often individuals or small groups of people, and the connections with criminal elements and unsavory elements of society. And you see that in those instances. You talked about China and India, but also in North America, where it's now legal in many states. But yet, there's still this culture of people betting into the black market because it's established and it's what people are used to. And also, I think they also know how badly bookmakers behave over there still, even if they're licensed. So,
yeah. I think that's right. And I don't want to underplay the dangers that can be associated with the black market. The term currently encompasses really anyone who isn't licensed to take bets from people in this jurisdiction. But that can be some extremely unsavory characters who, if you were to try and get paid out by them, you'd get an awful lot more problems than you would if it were a major licensed bookmaker. So I don't want to underplay that there is a huge, you know, say the black market's not a problem. It is. But all I'm saying is it's actually rather a hard thing to define. And actually, when you think of what a black market is, it's a market that isn't regulated, which exists around a market which is properly regulated. And if you've not got a market which is properly regulated, it's harder to define what a black market is, other than on the technicality, really, that they don't have licenses.
Aside from obviously the issues you're betting with a black market bookmaker of any description, what are the other considerations for punters if they're using them from a legal perspective? You know, are they people listening going, what issues could I face if beyond not getting paid if I win, if I start to use some of these operators?
Well, I'm certainly not going to recommend that people use black market operators for the reasons I've just given, is you never know who it is that ultimately you're placing a bet with. It might be some friendly chap on WhatsApp. You have no idea who it is that's standing the bet and what might happen if you tried to take them to court, for example. And the other thing is, the most dangerous thing, of course, is unregulated credit in the black market. And that's a very dangerous game. And no one should be doing that, is accepting credit from black market unlicensed operators. So with that caveat out the way, and it's a major caveat, my understanding, I'm not a criminal lawyer, my understanding is that people who place bets with bookmakers based abroad do not commit any criminal offence. And that makes sense. I don't think we want to change that. I don't think we want to criminalise punters in this jurisdiction placing bets with operators in foreign jurisdictions, not least because it would be very difficult for them to tell quite often who it is and what it is they're dealing with. And it's not always clear. This is the other thing about licensing, is you can have, as I said, lots of different, quite complex company structures with a holding company based in Curaçao with a very similar name, and it's not quite the name on the license in London, and then it's not quite the name on the website that you access from this jurisdiction. And it's hard to know in those circumstances where perhaps someone's pulled a fast one and actually they look like they're regulated here and licensed here, but they're not. Or simply the public register hasn't been properly updated and someone's not noticed the difference between, you know, LTD, for example, and limited in long form, or PLC or holdings or something like that. So it would be very unfair, in my view, to criminalize or criticize people for placing bets outside of this jurisdiction. For the reasons I give, it's a dangerous game. People do it very much at their own risk. You know, there's not a great deal to add to that. Ideally, always place your bets with a licensed bookmaker because they're regulated. You know, okay, we're not very happy with the quality of the regulation, but the major bookmakers are not going to turn up at your house at 2 o'clock in the morning. So at least you can sleep soundly on that basis. And I'm not sure that you always can if you're sort of doing what might be called more informal betting.
Good points. Well spoken. That's good. And let's move from black to white then. Let's talk about the white paper, which is the big story at the moment because there's this ongoing, it seems to be dragging on indeterminately at the moment, perhaps because of malaise in the government and likelihood of a change there, but maybe also due to the fact the Canberra commissioner in charge. And one of the things are affordability checks. That's a big issue for people at the moment. You know, someone tweeted on the 31st of January, make sure you've hit your deposit limit for January before the month is out.
It's like your ISA allowance. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It
yeah.
is. And I'm actually deposited, triggered me. I actually did it the day before and I was like, yes, I've already done mine. But obviously people are aware of some of the checks and what they can get away with, but how to circumnavigate them to make sure they can bet to the standards they wish to without onerous checks. Affordability checks, will they ever be realistically implemented? Do they even comply with things like GDPR? And they talk about frictionless affordability checks. Is that just...
There's absolutely no such thing as frictionless affordability checks that I have been able to ascertain any meaning of what that might mean. I just can't see how it would work. Data protection is not particularly my area, but I would say that someone who I've worked very closely with over the years, and although I didn't see firsthand evidence for this, but they told me about it, was that there is a major bookmaker who is now asking clients, customers, to get onto TeamViewer or the equivalent of it and log into their online banking so that the person, the operator, can go through their bank accounts with them online. Now, this is the real issue with affordability checks, is that it continues to place the onus for these financial investigations on the bookmaker. That is the fundamental problem. And it's the fundamental problem that, as far as I can see, the Gambling Commission won't address. At the same time as fining William Hill 90 million quid or whatever it is for failures, it is also saying, and we're going to massively increase your role in making sure you don't commit such breaches again in the future. It is the right hand punching the left hand in the face. It doesn't make any sense. Because bookmakers were not required to take their regulations seriously for a very long time, there is a culture of underinvestment and undertraining in their compliance teams. So they're not ready for this. They can't deal with the regulations as they are. They can't deal with their duties as they are. The number of emails I've seen over the years of people in the compliance team or the customer whatever team who just send completely incomprehensible requests for information, not for any nefarious purpose. They don't know what they're doing. They haven't been told what they're doing. And another huge one is constantly being asked for the same information or variations of it. The one that drove me mad, I hadn't used a particular account for ages and I want to have a bet on a football match. And tried to log in perhaps the first time in 2 months, which must, in retrospect, was probably suicide. But my account was frozen for 12 hours. So end of that particular bet. Obviously, I was able to place it elsewhere. But the problem emerged, turned out to be, I'm Henry on my birth certificate, not Harry. And that all the information I used was Henry, but my email address has Harry in it. And that had triggered some kind of issue for the bookmaker. And the result was that it froze my account for 12 hours. Now, someone with some basic training ought to have spotted that and gone, well, that's not a risk. Because of course, all these things are about the operator's assessment of risk. You don't have to be 100% positive that there is no problem. You have to satisfy yourself reasonably that there is no problem. And this is where they all fall down, is that because they have sent offshore call centers and all this sort of thing, it's full of people who just say no because it's much safer for their job just to say no. We now end up in a situation where we have got, by all accounts, these same operators, same teams, asking customers to log in to their online banking and go through it with them. It is absolutely terrifying if that is what's happening. And it shows already how utterly misguided the Gambling Commission are and the government are in thinking that the answer to the problems in gambling is to increase the regulatory role of bookmakers.
I don't know how many people would say, yes, I'll log into TeamViewer with a 20-year-old customer service operative from wherever in the world to look at my bank account.
Absolutely, Pete. But imagine you really need the money. Imagine that there's a substantial sum of money and you really need it.
Yeah.
You know, it puts you in a very difficult position in those circumstances. And you know that it will take weeks and months to get it if you don't do it. And you have no idea how long the person that you're dealing with has been at the job. You've no idea that they might not run off personally with your banking information and cause trouble with it. It is really worrying. And it was always very frustrating that bookmakers were given the role of regulating the finances of their customers and that people were endlessly having to send bank statements. Please now send unredacted versions of the bank statements. Here's my driving license. Please now send a photo of you standing next to your driving license and your passport with all your friends and family lined up behind you. It was ridiculous what people were being asked for, but it never was so invasive as asking to actually have live access to your bank statement, to your bank account, online banking facilities. I have no reason to doubt that the person who told me this is telling me the truth, but it shows that even the bookmakers, in my view, don't begin to understand what it is that they are now being asked to do. And they're engaged in an exercise of massive overkill.
And no doubt what may flow from this are more cases for you, Harry, all this access to this information.
We can only hope, but yeah, who knows? The one thing about the gambling industry is every time you think, well, that particular practice has stopped or that particular issue has come, it just, you know, every time a sort of one hole is plugged with a cork, it seems to result in 10 other holes opening in the bottle and water continuing to spill out. So we'll see, I suppose, is the answer.
And you represent a few smaller independent bookmakers. And one of the issues that bookmakers are talking about, especially smaller firms, is the level of work and commitment in terms of time and resource to oversee these checks. Is the school of thought that the big firms are quite happy because they have the resource and they can kind of handle it and it removes the competition or removes any interrupters into the industry to challenge them because the amount of resource? Do you think that's a fair comment?
I think that's a really fair comment. And it does apply to regulation in all industries. And it's why when some governments come in, they say we're going to take a pair of scissors to red tape because it is a huge cost to business regulation. And that goes for lawyers and accountants and everyone. But yeah, absolutely. It must be very difficult for independents to keep up with this sort of thing. And yes, absolutely. It probably is a competitive advantage for these big organizations who have the resources and to an extent the infrastructure to do it. But the real thing at the moment is it's just not clear what it is that people really are expected to do. I know that financial crime is very sophisticated, so you can't be completely prescriptive about how you search for it. But equally, it can't just be, and this is where I have real sympathy for bookmakers, is the fines, because I've spoken to lots of bookmakers about this. They don't begin to understand the basis upon which they are being fined. And they very often don't understand with good reason what it is that's expected of them until someone from the Gambling Commission comes in and tells them they've done it wrong. Now, there's always a little bit of an element of that in regulation, which is, well, we'll know what you've done wrong once we've seen it. But it seems to be particularly pervasive in gambling regulation, which is that they go into these operators, go, why have you done that? Why? Well, what is that in breach of? And then they can point to anything, frankly, in the LCCP, because the duties are very broad. And if anyone can tell me why one bookmaker is fined 3 million and one why is fined by 90 million, there's just absolutely no explanation for that on any of the things that the Gambling Commission have published, so far as I can see anyway, because they have this habit of giving you rather sort of breathless summaries of some of the breaches they found. But summaries of breaches doesn't give you an idea of the extent of breaches. And so I have real sympathy with even the bigger bookmakers on that front, which is just, well, actually, is the guidance clear enough? It really probably isn't.
No, and I've heard that reiterated from the companies I've spoken to who've said the same. I don't think there's a culture of wanting to game that or circumnavigate these rules. They actually want to apply them, but it's a lack of clarity. And the other question from that would be, where does all the money from these fines actually go? And perhaps it should be going to the good causes like the National Lottery, and that might be a way forward. But I'm not going to go down the rabbit. I want to ask you some other questions while I have you on, actually. I appreciate you taking up your time. So I had a few other random questions, and I was going to ask you about betting dispute services. We've got IBAS, we've got eCogra. Many punters with experience of using don't even bother these days. They choose to either go to small claims court or perhaps to people like yourself. What's your experience of these dispute services been?
Well, again, the same caveat as the Gambling Commission is that we gave up on them quite some time ago. So again, it could have improved, but they're not positive is how I would sum it up. I don't buy into understandable frustrations on Twitter where people say they're bent or working for the bookmakers, but you do get the impression that they start on the basis the punter is trying it on and that you've kind of got to get over that hurdle first. And in my experience, they are often a little bit too quick to assume that the bookmaker is within its rights. And the other thing that was very frustrating for the clients that I had that used it, I don't know if they've improved, but it could be an unbelievably lengthy process, I remember, and with no real guidelines or explanations as to why it had taken so long. But I do think we need to be careful on this because, you know, and there's lots of support for this idea of an ombudsman, but a lot of ombudsmen operate on very similar basis, you know, and in many ways, IBAS and ECOGRA, that's sort of what they were. I'm not sure that just the establishment of an ombudsman is going to be the tonic that a lot of punters think it might be.
I think it may well go down to the funding of the ombudsman and also who runs it. And I think that's the query for some of those at the moment, whereby yes, their funding is directly correlated to the number of cases and which bookmakers and so on. So that's another topic we can explore.
Yes, but I can't remember what they were called, but before the Gambling Act, these bodies existed that used to sort of adjourn over disputed bets and things. I can't remember what they were called, but they've always existed slightly in the shadows, you know, not to suggest anything improper, but it's never been a particularly transparent process. And the reasoning that you get is quite often not very well explained. But as I say, you can get that with ombudsmen for very big industries as well. So it could be an improvement in terms of people's concerns on the appearance of bias. But I'm not sure that we should be getting too excited about a gambling ombudsman.
Well, hopefully no one has to use them. That would be the ideal solution. We'd get it resolved with the bookmaker. The terms and conditions, I've heard you talk about that in the past. Are they overly lengthy? Are they very unclear? You know, are they trying to cover as many potential topics as possible? What's your take on that at the moment? Do they need to be improved? Are they deliberately trying to mislead punters?
Some are, you would be forgiven for thinking that they are drafted in such a way as to simply put off punters from trying to enforce what are probably their rights. Because of course, there's a difference between what a contract says and whether it's enforceable. But many punters won't bridge that gap because they won't go to lawyers, for example, and who can blame them? You shouldn't have to spend money on lawyers to get money if you're entitled to it. But yeah, I've seen some dreadful terms over and conditions over the years. Ones that have suggested that any kind of error, for example, as I think I was saying earlier, any kind of error is something that they can change after the event. So not a palpable error, just the word error. Now, you could argue that it was an error to lay a bet to someone that you didn't realize knew what they were talking about. In other words, a commercial error. Now, no court is going to enforce it like that. But if you were to say to someone who is perhaps relatively legally and commercially unsophisticated, oh, sorry, yeah, no, that's an error and we're not going to explain to you what the error is, that person might go, yeah, all right, well, bang to rights, or, you know, oh, I'm not comfortable going to lawyers, whatever. So there probably is an element in the terms and conditions that they're not really designed to be effective at trial, but they're designed to have an effect in terms of getting rid of a certain number of what might otherwise be legitimate complaints.
Well, that's what people do often. People come to me and they raise some of these potential issues and say they've been told it's, you know, this particular clause and it's not particularly clear. Is this fair? So it would appear that there needs to be more clarity on that front.
Yeah, I think on some of them there certainly does, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you so much for your time. I have many other questions I could have asked, but I'm just going to finish off because in terms of a way forward, because I've heard you speak about the best approach would be to split up a casino-style betting from just general sports betting. And we're actually interesting news. We're seeing this unfold in Belgium now. They're taking that approach almost. I think you see it in some countries where they have a separate wallet for casino and maybe for sports betting and perhaps different licenses. Why do you believe that would be a solution to the problems here? And do you think it might ever be implemented?
I think it would solve a number of social problems. I am old enough that I remember what betting shops were like before FOBTs were going into them. And they weren't all a barrel of laughs. There was almost a sense of community in some of them. It's interesting psychologically, I wouldn't go into the Ladbrokes near my child's school for fear of being seen to come out of it. And that would never have been my dad's approach to, for example, to coming out of a bookies. That would just be a pastime, something he's interested in. Now it's associated with something entirely different, and it's associated with huge glass things up over the counter. You can very rarely go into the ones that I have up the road here in Shepherd's Bush that there isn't someone screaming, throwing chairs around at some point during the day.
Yeah.
Alarms going off, police turning up. Certainly you got troubled punters in bookmakers in the old days watching greyhound racing and sports racing and horse racing and football. But it was nothing like what you have with fixed odds terminals. I cannot see that there is a positive social reason for casino betting, fixed odds betting, to be as accessible as it is. I just don't think there is one. Is taking money away from, for example, horse racing. I know that historically some people in horse racing have thought, well, actually, we need fob tees because that keeps people in betting shops and that keeps betting shops open, and it's betting shops being open that gets us funded under the levy. But ultimately, it is taking customer interest away from sports punting, and it is putting it into the irritating phrase of crack cocaine of gambling. But it has to be said that it is infinitely more addictive. It is not a challenge. You don't apply your brain to it. You don't apply analysis. You don't learn anything. It's not what most people would refer to as a sensible pastime, hobby, or interest. It is a way of slowly transferring a certain amount of your money to a bookmaker for a short dopamine hit the last seconds. But the other thing it's done is it has changed the approach of bookmakers towards sports punting. They now consider it, many of them, a loss leader. Get people in on through horse racing, through football betting, and get them as quickly as you can onto the fixed odds betting machines, because, of course, there's the guaranteed margins there. It seems to me that it must happen, it will happen, in my view, that there are significant curbs put on fixed odds betting or the accessibility to it, and it will end up with you having to go. You know, it wasn't very long ago. Do you remember, Pete? If you wanted to go into a casino at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning after you'd been out, there was this ridiculous, you had to join the casino in order to go. Some of them said, I think it was supposed to be a 24-hour cooling off period or something. So you'd go back at 2 o'clock the next morning to get in and sort of get £2.50 next to taxi drivers and that kind of thing at 3 o'clock in the morning on roulette. And that's where it belongs, really. I can't see any good that comes from it. I can only see bad. And the real problem is that because the media don't distinguish when they are talking about the ills of gambling, they don't distinguish between sports books and casino, sports punting is going to be dragged down with it if we're not careful. That is the point that I think is most important, is that anyone who is interested in value betting in sports should be doing their utmost to sing from the rooftops that we are not, this is not fixed odds betting. It's a different thing, and they should be regulated differently as a consequence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you have to walk into any physical casino and see how many zombies, you know, pulling at machines and for several hours would have given their money away to the casino. And like I said, there is no skill, and the impact is significant on sports betting. I'm not going to name firms, but there's a few at the moment who are in the UK, including one firm with big budgets, who are advertising extensively on horse racing, yet they are not interested in laying a bet on horse racing.
No.
Everyone I've spoken to has had their account gone or limited to 50 pence because they only see that as a gateway or a loss leader for people to go and lose a lot of money on their casino.
You're welcome to use our fixed odds betting products without restriction, is usually the message that people get when they get restricted in these circumstances. Well, no surprises there. Going back to casino, I remember sitting next to a woman who spoke almost no English, watching roulette. She was writing down the numbers that were coming on the roulette table to try and spot patterns. So perhaps it's not quite right that you can't apply your intelligence to fixed odds betting. But it's not a good thing. And it's a really bad thing for people who want to make, not even people who want to make money out of sports punting, but people who want to be able to do it. And in my view, it's a really bad thing for a sport like horse racing, which is so closely reliant on gambling, to basically say, well, we're not just reliant on this kind of gambling. We're actually reliant on this slightly more sinister relative. And if I were in position of a higher status in horse racing, I would be making that point very, very strongly.
I agree. And hopefully it seems like one of the most sensible things that could take place. But obviously there's so many vested interests and so much money to be made from casino style betting that it might be a hard argument to win until perhaps industries like horse racing hit rock bottom. But, you know, I believe one of the guys in the BHA made his money on slot machines. So he's probably not going to be voting for that anytime soon.
That's right. It's a difficult one. And there are huge vested interests. And of course, we've had one of the big differences that could have happened. We could have had Jeremy Corbyn, you see, and that would have, I think, made a very big difference. I'm not making a political point here as to whether I think we should have had him by any stretch. But we have had for 13 years a very an increasingly libertarian government, which is actually one of the strange things about these affordability checks. We're a general election away, in my view, from having a seriously different landscape in gambling.
Well, there we go. Well, we're not too far away. What, maybe 12 months' time, we'll know.
It's not necessarily this general election. My point is that given the way politics now seems to be operating, where you have increasing, you know, extremists tended not to get into power, and that no longer seems to be the case. And my point is that actually, I think that there are political movements that could really do a great deal of either good or damage, depending on how they approach. I'm talking medium term rather than immediate short term.
Okay.
We shouldn't assume that things will just continue the way they're going.
Sure. We'll watch this space. We'll see where it goes. Because at the moment, it's been very slow moving. We haven't really seen much change or clarity. So, you know, the next year or two, at the very least, we'll start to see a pathway develop and maybe some positive development. So for those people who are listening to this and thinking they might need a gambling lawyer now or potentially in the future, how best can people find you and connect with you?
Just Google me, I think is the answer. My firm is Gardner Leader. I'm a partner there based in the London office, and I'm always happy to chat to anyone about gambling and sports in particular. And if I think I can help, I'll let them know and pretty quickly. And if I don't, then I'll say so.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. First time I've had a legal mind on the podcast, and, you know, able
and,
to...
And last. Yeah.
Well, no, it's great to be able to throw some questions that people have about the whole range of problems that people have at the moment in the industry and get a sense from someone that very much works on the punter side or works with smaller independent bookmakers and understands that. And that's the key difference with yourself. So thank you ever so much, Harry. Real pleasure chatting to you, and look forward to connecting further in the future.
Cheers, Pete. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this very latest Smart Betting Club podcast. If you enjoyed it and are keen to find out more on how the SBC service can help you and your betting, you can save 5% on the cost of membership simply by using the coupon code PODCAST. Visit smartbettingclub.com, hit subscribe, and enter the coupon code PODCAST to save 5%.